My name is Rudy Kelly, and I am an Aboriginal.
I am Chief.
My dad was a great chief of the Tsimshian Nation, beloved by his people. But at home, with his family, he brought anger and pain. He told me that to succeed, I would have to leave everything behind. Now I'm on a journey to find out who and what my dad really was. The Aboriginal is an all-new CBC podcast. Available now.
This is a CBC podcast.
Danse, Anine, Bouju, hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Music making is one way Indigenous artists share their stories. They might mash up some techno with a powwow drum beat, or mix a little Afro-Indigenous inspiration to that dance tune, or add a heavy dash of cultural wisdom to that song.
It was Goosebumps.
Inspired by a recording of his Tapan Cree musician Merrick Tyler, put Protocol first in his solo album as Ko.
So for me, I really wanted to lean into the process of Protocol. The protocols that go into working culturally and creatively in contemporary art, but also learning how to pass along that information so that I do it in a respectful way.
And from dropping beats at community weddings to mashups on the fashion runway, how DJ Osho took charge of her own show.
I just cut out the middleman and started my own business, and it's been an incredible ride ever since.
Plus, it was hip-hop that first brought Joshua DePerry to the powwow drum. Now, Joshua's powwow techno really gets his feather bustle bouncing.
You can hear it. You can hear the Madewagan beating in your heart and just keep that rhythm going. And that's when I fell in love. And I said, Bumma P to hip-hop, and I went straight to techno and house.
Today, Indigenous music makers who are creating new beats while honoring the harmonies of their ancestors. Every good party needs a good DJ. Their playlists, mixed with electrifying beats, always get people on the dance floor. Aureen Askew, also known as DJ Osho, knows this all too well. She's an Afro-Indigenous Two-Spirit DJ from the Squamish Nation. But Aureen isn't just any other DJ. She's a mentor, teaching young people how to break into the industry. And she's doing it one cool beat at a time. Aureen, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, how did you get your start in DJing?
I was born and raised in Vancouver, BC, and I took radio broadcasting. So music has just always been there, and I was kind of going around it, you know, working CSR, customer service jobs, and just anything I could, and then playing parties on the side. And then I finally decided to start my own DJing business in 2012 because I was working for other people. And then I kind of learned the industry and crowd control and a lot of things like that. So I just cut out the middleman and started my own business. And it's been an incredible ride ever since.
Is there something in particular about, you know, playing music from other people and, you know, making beats and stuff that, you know, singing doesn't do or playing in a band wouldn't quite fulfill you?
Well, I think because I'm Afro-Indigenous, I've been exposed to a lot of culture, a lot of different cultures. So the two, they're very similar, but it's always been around me, like the drum beat. We always talk about the importance of the drum beat, how it's like the baby in the mom's womb. It's like a heartbeat, you know? And music just makes us, our traditional songs make us feel so good, so good. And I can't really put it into words, but it's like, it's healing. It's really healing.
Yeah. What is your earliest memory of, you know, playing DJ? I mean, when I was a kid, I used to like talking to those little microphones. You remember the little kids' microphones? Press record and do the little, hello, I'm Rosanna and I am your radio host. What is your earliest memory?
Oh, mine's kind of similar. I used to make mix CDs back in those days. We used to burn CDs for friends, if anyone knows what that means. That's but people would request them from me. So like my friends, they would ask for specific songs and I would just kind of like make it my own and, you know, put my voice on there in between tracks or just freestyle or something to make it really unique. So I've been doing it without knowing it since I was about 13 years old.
Aww. I'm sure somebody out there still has one of your original OG DJ CDs.
Yeah, for sure.
What are some of the challenges that you face in particular as an Afro-Indigenous woman and a Two-Spirit artist?
Yeah, that's just four extra layers to add to the scenario. my friends will say I'm so intersectional that I need my own traffic light. And that
I like that.
They're so creative. I get all my ideas from them. But yeah, being a woman, I feel like in this industry, I've had to prove myself, like work 10 times more harder. And it's been challenging, but it's almost something that I wouldn't change because I feel like I had to prove myself. And I have, and it's gotten me to a place where I'm at right now. You know, there's not very many female DJs. There's more coming out now, which is really cool to see. But, you know, sound techs, sometimes they would just treat me like I didn't know what I was talking about. And I'm thinking, like, I've gone to school for this. I might know a bit more than you do about this.
I got my own intersection, bro. Can you share an example of maybe, you know, some of the obstacles that you had to overcome as a BIPOC DJ?
Just funding and getting started. You know, my nation, the Squamish Nation, back then we had a small business program where you could do a business plan and get some startup money for your small business. And luckily, you know, DJing is mobile. So you just kind of buy your stuff and you're on your way. And that's exactly what I did. I was doing, you know, weddings, birthday parties, just anywhere they needed music. And I was one of the only ones doing it in Vancouver. And I'm from one of the host nations, so Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. So I'd be in each community, like doing weddings and birthday parties, because I was the only one that really did that in their communities.
Mm. And how did, you know, usually when you think of DJs, there's lots of men, it's lots of men in there. How did they react to you as you were making your way through the music scene?
I've been around guys like my whole entire life, like the biggest tomboy. Like in elementary school, I'd be playing football at recess and lunch. And I have two brothers. So I feel like I said, I kind of had to prove myself. But then once they've seen I know what I'm doing, they kind of like want to work with me more and stuff like that. Like being in a boardroom full of men trying to convince them to have a pajama party at their club, you know, like they were like, I don't know. And then, you know, we talk more about it and they gave me a chance and they're requesting me to throw more parties now because the party turned out great. It's just being unique, and I've found my niche and having something different. I think that's what DJing is all about now. People don't want, it's not the same old, you know, 50s radio host, you know, that voice. It's like they want something authentic and real and someone who's going to really have a conversation with you and treat you like a real person.
And now that you mentor others, what inspired you to want to teach another generation of DJs?
Well, I think it's in our teachings for sure. Since I was a young, very young person, you know, our elders, like, you know, you teach people what you know, and I feel like when I first started out, it was kind of like people were like, you know, oh, kind of scared of like competition, you know, and it's like, I'm not here to steal your gigs because I can't play like you and you can't play like me. So that's what I try to tell my students, you know, there is competition, but there isn't really, if you think about it, because you're a different, completely different human being and you want to be really creative and bring something out that's different. And I feel like that teaching from our elders and my grandmother too, is you pass down what you know so others can have it too.
Mm, that's beautiful. Can you walk me through, you know, maybe one of your classes? What are some of the things that you teach them?
Well, I teach them the basics, basically what we're doing behind the computer, because I think everybody, like a lot of people who are at parties and stuff, like, well, I've seen it where they come and stand behind me and they're looking over my shoulder, probably wondering what the heck I'm doing, or they know what I'm doing and they're trying to see how I'm doing it. So basically in the first lesson, it's almost like just to show them the gist of it, like the gist of making a 45-minute mix that you can put on SoundCloud. Because by the end of my teaching them, it's about 6 weeks long, they should be able to make a 45-minute mix like on their own without any help from me or anything. So we go through like every single step from, you know, downloading music, analyzing music, going through the beats per minute. And that's an interesting thing to teach some people, because sometimes they can't get the beat and they're just so confused. They're like, how do you get it? You just get it. Or, you know, I'm like, well, I am Afro-Indigenous. It's like in my DNA. So, but if you're willing to put the work in, we're going to figure it out and we're going to do it. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing just seeing from the first lesson to the last lesson, just how much they've changed and grown, and they're really listening. And sometimes, you know, the younger students, they don't even listening, you know, they're like spinning around in a chair, and I'm like, yeah, I don't think your parents are going to like that very much. But then their parents come in and they show them, and I'm like, oh wow, they're listening to me.
They are always listening, for sure. Let's talk a little bit about more about those changes. What do you see, you know, as they enter your class and as they develop, what kind of growth do you see as they move through the workshop with you?
I would say confidence, you know, them coming in and just not really, like, almost being intimidating, because the boards that I use or that we use have maybe about 50 or 60 different controls on them. So when I set it down and the kind of look of horror on their face, like, wow. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to teach you exactly what each button does. And they're like, really? I'm like, yeah, that's what we're going to do. That's what we're going to do for the next 6 weeks. And they're just like mind blown. But then seeing them do it themselves and knowing from, like, it's almost like a before and after phase. And it's amazing. And especially when they start playing gigs and they'll give me updates. And sometimes I hire former students if I'm throwing the party, which is really cool too, that I'm able to do that, like work with them and stuff.
Mm. In addition to mentoring DJs, you also incorporate your own culture into your sets. How are you doing that?
So lately I've been getting hired by the pro athletic teams for either Pride Night, Black Excellence Night, or Indigenous Night. DJ Osho. So it's really interesting, because it's like, you know, okay, so they're hiring me to play an Indigenous celebration night. Like, I should probably play some Indigenous artists, maybe something people haven't thought of or heard of before. And for me, I always try to incorporate that anyways. So even if it wasn't First Nations celebration night, I would do that. Like, I sneak in like an Indigenous artist that I really like, or a Black artist that I really like. So I think it's so cool to be able to play like your cultures when you're DJing and you get hired for that. Like, I know it's 2024, but I've never seen anything like that before. And I've been in this industry for more than 10 years.
Yeah. And how do people react to your, you know, your mixes, your unique mixes as you stand in this intersection?
Yeah, they love it. And it's funny because, you know, they're like, oh, your sets are so good. And you know what? Literally, I just play what I think my aunties would like. And it's worked out. Aww. It's worked out for me.
I just have this vision of a row of aunties sitting there at your sets, doing their auntie things, bopping along. Oh, that's good, my girl. That's really good.
Yeah, I'm like, and I tell them, because I do have a group of aunties who do that sometimes. They'll come to my gigs and I'm like, trying to get rich and famous so I can just bring them everywhere, because they're security too. It's great.
Auntie security. I like it. Get them their own little t-shirts.
Yeah, for sure.
And as you continue to mentor and expand on the scene with your unique sound, what changes do you want to see in this industry's landscape?
Yeah, definitely more DJs that are like me, Indigenous DJs, Black DJs, Two-Spirit DJs. And I think they're coming in Vancouver. The scene has been it's changing so much. Like, there's so many more queer parties now. And I just saw there's this place called the Birdhouse. They have parties there, like, every weekend, queer parties. And if you want to be a DJ, they have, like, an open decks night. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's incredible. Because they didn't really have that many when I was first starting out. So it's like they're trying. They're trying to uplift those queer folks to get into DJing by having nights like those. So I'm excited for the change. And I'm excited to hand it off because I am getting older. I asked for the early sets because I'm going to be 41 in a few weeks. So.
So you and your aunties can get it out of the way and then go home and drink some tea.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for your time today and sharing a little bit of what you do.
Thank you for having me.
That's DJ Osho, an Afro-Indigenous Two-Spirit DJ from the Squamish Nation. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild.
In late 2007, the remains of a young woman from the Kaska Nation were discovered in the Yukon woods.
I always think about, I want to know what really happened.
So I travel north to try to understand what happened and who was involved.
It's a pretty big risk to come forward with the information that I have.
I'm David Ridgen, and this is Someone Knows Something, Season 8, The Angel Carlick Case. Available now.
From following cultural protocols to evolving the art of the mashup, these Indigenous music makers make their own way while still honoring their ancestors' way. And they're passing it on to future generations. 4 years ago, Merrick Tyler's mom shared a precious family heirloom. It was a set of recordings from the 1960s and 70s that featured his great-great-grandfather, or Tappan, Francis Harper. Hearing that recording was the beginning of an important journey for Merrick. It's one that's brought him a greater sense of connection to his family and community and has now resulted in a solo music project called Asco. Merrick is Nheyo and Scottish-Irish from Onion Lake Cree Nation. He's an artist and musician. Merrick, welcome to Unreserved.
Dante, it's really nice to meet you.
Take me back to that moment when you first heard your Chapan's voice in that recording. What happened?
It was goosebumps. Well, it's goosebumps for me because I've always had a bit of a connection with Tappan Harper simply because of a photograph that I had known about and seen for years, which is when he was holding me in front of the shack that he raised my mom in when she wasn't at residential school. And it's a small little shack, and there I am in a onesie at 16 months old. He was just holding me. And so I've always remembered that photograph. Then I got to put a voice to that face.
I love that little baby image of little baby Merrick in his little onesie.
Styling onesie.
And what was it like hearing the voice of your Japan?
It moved me because there was a voice that I've always wanted to hear. It was also really challenging because I don't speak Cree. I'm not a fluent Nehiwewan speaker. So I heard him speaking and I just wanted to learn what he had said. And that was the beginning of this journey, of this path, of this, you know, trying to put together an advisory group built of my uncle De La Oasis, my mom, Linda Young, and Dr. Diana Steinhauer. The three of us, plus myself, the four of us now, listened to these recordings. And my great-great-grandfather, Tappan Harper, he seemed to speak in an old Cree, an old Nehiwewan, that was, it was harder to translate because it was old terminology. And we started identifying teachings, lessons, learnings, requests that Tappan Harper was saying and stating. And we tried to find out exactly, you know, what that meant to me and what that meant to us and how could we reflect that back to him.
Did you eventually find out what he had said in that recording?
He spoke about his childhood. He spoke about the need to pass along our culture, the need to not lose our culture. Now, we have to think about the environment that he was in. This was in the 60s and 70s. So you're at the, not I'm not sure the pinnacle of the residential school, but the absolute fallout of generations of families going through residential schools. And I think what we heard from Zapban was his request to trust our culture, his request to teach our culture, to start living with each other and alongside each other and learning from each other. To kind of grow that symbiotic relationship between non-Indigenous and Indigenous people. And you heard that over time and time again, kind of in his what he was saying, just asking for community to step up and to start being proud of who they are and what they're doing, and to start passing along that knowledge so that we can keep it and we can share it. Mm.
That's beautiful. Tell me a little bit about your Chapan. Who was Francis Harper?
The first time I saw him was in a picture with two of his cousins, and they had long, long hair braids. It was a black and white photo, and it looked like it was in winter, and they're in like the willow. And I loved it. I used to just look at that photograph. That's the first time I had heard of him. My mom didn't speak much about him growing up, probably because of, you know, residential school does, it's a lot, that's a lot to bring up for someone, you know. But the more that I learned of him, I learned that he loved horses. He loved his black cowboy hat. And when we started pulling together protocol for the advisors, one of the things we did is we bought and purchased a black cowboy hat for my uncle, Dale Oasis, kind of in honoring of my Zapan. And that was, along with the other protocol, one of the honorariums or one of the gifts was a black cowboy hat. Mom says that he was firm, but he was, very wise. And, I've always felt a connection to him. And going through this process, through creative work or ceremonial work or all that, you always kind of feel that connection that, like his hand is just on your shoulder. Like you're doing okay. It's going to be okay. You got this.
Yeah. In terms of learning about the, the protocols and the ceremonies around translating such wisdom, Can you give me an example of a teaching that was shared during that process without, of course, giving away anything too sacred?
Isn't that interesting how we have to, like, that's part of the learning is like what we share and what we care for, like what we hold. Mm-hmm. When I was listening to, again, I do not speak Cree. I didn't understand exactly what he was saying, but the translation said, we need to trust our culture. We need to share our culture. We need to teach our culture to the next generations. They can't lose it. But his voice it sounded like it was critical. It was definite that we needed to do this. When I heard that, I thought of there's a powwow dance, it's called the chicken dance. And my friend Seth Cardinal Dodging Horse is a chicken dancer. When I saw the chicken dance and I heard Seth's story about how he was given or they were given the chicken dance, for me, there was a direct link, a thread from my great-grandfather's wanting of our culture to be passed along to the story of the chickens gifting a dancer their dance and saying, if you do not share this dance, if you do not teach this dance, we will come back and take it from you. Seth Cardinal Dodging Horse from Sitsika and his family is also from Saddle Lake gifted me the story and gifted me the dance and the video. We exchanged protocol, Seth and I, so that one, I could work with the video, but number two is so that I could learn his story or their story and their dance and hopefully do my best to explain it and honor, that teaching, which is to pass along our culture to the next generation, the way that Zapan, mm-hmm. Zapan Harper had asked.
Mm. And what kind of music did you create out of his words? Did you incorporate his actual voice in the music, or was this more of an inspired songs by him?
It's an inspired piece. So my process was listen to the translations with my advisors, ask my advisors all sorts of questions. Who owns this work? How do I share this work? Like these long discussions that all were seeded by what Zapan Harper had said. And we started identifying teachings, identifying themes. And then what I tried to do was find family songs or family dances or powwow dances that reflected those teachings. So specifically for Nisis, which means uncle, and the chicken dance, I wanted to reflect some of those teachings that in the physical world, men care for and take care of the big drum. And so I wanted to put the big drum and make it a feature part of the song. And how I did that was by taking the video of Seth Cardinal Dodging Horse and their footwork. And every time he hit the ground, I put a bass drum. Doom, 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 doom. And I loved the process of just starting to do that. Just starting to work with Seth in their footwork. And then, you know, they would have a bustle flourish. And it was beautiful. It was gorgeous. So I wanted, you know, something to accent that bustle flourish. So walking through the entire video, I started placing rhythm every time they made a flourish on their footwork and started building the song out of that. For me, hopefully the process reflected what I was offering back to Tapan in his original ask to pass along our culture from generation to generation.
That's beautiful. What a wonderful process. Earlier, you talked about the importance of protocols and making sure all of those things show up in your work. How did it show up in this work?
Well, protocol leads every conversation. So, you know, I asked my mom, you know, how do we start this? And she told me, she advised me on what protocol to offer. I asked my uncle, Dale Oasis, you know, how do I get going? He goes, well, we need to feast. So we did a feast on, you know, for my great-great-grandfather, someone who's made that next step long time ago, you know. And then with my mom's advice and my Uncle Dale's advice, I put together a protocol for my advisor, which included them and Diana Steinhauer. And then the collaboration, the creative part started happening. So how do I work with Seth Cardinal Dodging Horse in this, you know, to collaborate with them on their dance or their video? It's through protocol. It's that commitment to them and their commitment to us to follow this through to the end. Now, for Seth, we started that a couple years ago. And yesterday, I had another question about the dance. So sure enough, they got on a call with me and we had a really good conversation. He, you know, they are still committed to this process. And I hope it's because of the commitment through protocol. So now we have to present the work. So that's an interesting conversation. How do we present this information to the public in a respectful way that continues to care for and make that commitment to this project? So before you and I started talking, I made sure that I smudged and made sure that I spoke as truthfully as possible and wanted to carry that with me. Anytime I present or perform music, I extend traveling protocols to the territory that I'm going to. So you're in Winnipeg. I would reach out to a local Indigenous organization or friends who I have that I do know there and ask them, I'm coming to your territory to be a guest in your territory. My teachings are we practice the protocols of the lands we're guests on. And I want to conduct myself in a way that is respectful to you so that I, you know, so that I'm in that good way, in that old way, you know.
Ho,
you know. So, but the process of doing that, it affords me the opportunity to make a connection with the community to where I'm going to. It allows me to invite them, or not invite them, but let them know that this is happening. Let them know that the door is always open and there's always room.
What about the challenges when you're talking about protocols and you're talking about, you know, carrying on those teachings? Are there challenges in trying to, for example, go into a bar and play this music or somewhere they're serving alcohol?
That's a really, really good question. There are protocols that say that we cannot bring a drum into that venue. We can't bring an eagle feather into that venue or other protocol into that venue. So what I did and getting the approval from my advisory is like, I really want to perform this music. You know, how do I do it? And they said, and they said, well, I don't know. You tell us how you want to do it. I said, well, how about I sample my cultural drums? So I know in Radioland, you can't see this, but behind me, I have hand drums over here and I have other drums and rattles and shakers. And these are all cultural instruments, but I sampled them all. and I put them into an electronic drum kit that I now can play in venues. I think I've done I've followed protocol in not bringing those ceremonial instruments in, but a reimagined sound of them.
I'm interested to know, why is it important to honor those protocols and to take that commitment, as you say, all the way through and all the way to the end?
You know, rehearsing in the basement with your friends, preparing a show, I used to close my eyes and I would see the audience in front of me and I'd wonder how they'd react. Would they like this? Now when I close my eyes and I think about presenting the work, I see family, I see community. I think that working in this way challenges you to work it challenges you to work differently. Here's another example of it. I'm not a beater, but if I wanted to learn how to beat, I could probably go onto YouTube and find someone who could teach me how to beat, maybe Lazy Stitch or whatever it might be, or maybe I'm going to use seed beads or I'm going to use glass beads. You know, I'd find someone there and then I can take that out and I could sell it. But what I've done is I've taken a art form and I've profited from it, but I have no responsibility to it or the teacher. So this affords me the opportunity to learn from my family and from my generations of my family, to do it in a way that I can still offer it, but still be accountable to and kept on account by family, so that it's no longer about me. It's about community. It's about family. It's about respecting how it was done and how we can do it. And just removing yourself from the end result and just putting yourself in the process of supporting all of it. Hmm. Yeah.
Or the gift giver.
Not
the gift receiver.
Another one of the teachings that mom has passed along is like, you know, when you want to make an offering, you make an offering till it hurts. And what I mean by that is, if you wanted to make a donation of money to an event, you could say, well, I have $100 and I'll give $10. And that's great. That's awesome. But if you have $100 and you give $50, well, that's amazing. That's a gift. You know, that's an offering. So again, for this, I just want to offer it to back to my tap band as best as I can by following the protocols of my family. And hopefully, you know, they're proud of me. And hopefully I'm doing something that's in line with our teachings, but still moves the needle forward. And I'm able to share our knowledge, you know, and find empathy for ourselves, and include people to dispel myth, you know, include other cultures. I mean, I'm half Nehio. I have Irish and Scottish in me. Like, it's not just for Indigenous people. It's for my community, which is non-Indigenous as well. Like, I want to dispel myth through inclusion.
Mm. And Merrick, as you think back, you know, 4 years ago when you first heard your Chapant voice, to the journey that you've been on, and knowing that your great great grandfather wanted these teachings to be passed on and wanted this culture to be revived and reclaimed and all of those beautiful things, what do you think he would say to you?
Oh God, that's a great question. I think that's a question I'm going to ask my mom. You know, what would he say to me? Eksama, eksama. That's what I'd hope he would say to me. You know, good job, Mio Sin. Good job. That would just
you're giving me the feels. Seriously. I might cry a little bit.
I hope he sees what we're doing. Like, not just me, but like, I hope he sees what my uncle and my mom and my nieces and my nephews and my sisters are doing. You know, my brothers. I hope he sees that we're doing our best. And, you know, I might not speak Cree fluently, and when I do, I speak with an English accent, but that's okay. It's okay to speak with an English accent because it's the truth. And I don't, you know, that's, yeah, so I, Iksama. Mm-hmm. Mm.
And also ancestors don't judge.
No, I hope not. Yeah, mm-hmm, absolutely.
Mm, can I ask him in? Thank you so much.
Maestas.
Merrick Tyler is Niheo and Scottish-Irish from Onion Lake Cree Nation. His debut solo project is As Co. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. All of our guests today are definitely dancing to the beat of their own drums. And that reminded us of Joshua DePerry, who was on the show last season. Joshua is a fancy dancer who you might find strutting his traditional style at a powwow. But he's also a music producer and DJ. That's one of Joshua's mashups, who also performs as Classic Roots. It's a blend of powwow and electronic music to create powwow techno. And that's not his only mashup. Joshua wears his dance regalia during his live stream DJ sets, and the heavy hitting beats really gets his feather bustle bouncing. Joshua, welcome to Unreserved.
Hi there. Bonjour.
Danse. So Joshua, how would you describe the power of music?
I'd say it's you can go through six dimensional layers into music, and you can hop in there and it becomes therapeutic. It takes your depression away, your anxiety, you know, that's your space. No one can take that away from you. So that's the power of music.
Do you feel like music is in your soul?
Definitely. Even in our culture too, you know, the Madewagun, the heartbeat of that drum, you feel that heartbeat relating to Ake, Mother Earth. You know, you're connecting to both worlds, and, you know, no matter how you hate or love music, it's there.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. As you said, no powwow, and particularly the powwow drum, is considered the heartbeat of our nations. And, you know, we have a very strong connection to that. Tell me about the first time you were introduced to powwow and powwow music.
I was introduced when I was up in Thunder Bay. I'm born and raised in Thunder Bay. I always go to the Thunder Mountain powwow every year. So I had a grass outfit. My mom always telling me, like, I always had a lot of energy as I dance out there and listening to the drums. You know, as a kid, that's where my, you know, ADHD and hyperness go straight to the dance and use that energy for a good cause. That's how good the powwow is. And especially, you know, learning from your elders, and elders tell you about stories from, you know, 100 years ago. Like, the elders are there for us to learn and take that knowledge and give it to the next generation.
Mm. Do you remember the first time that you danced in your regalia and felt that connection and that beat?
Yeah. I mean, I can fast forward to when I was 14. That's when I got into breakdancing, and then I got into power. I went back to powwowing, and the very first time I had my first fancy outfit regalia, it was a blue one, and it was representing the healing. I remember just stepping in the Lakehead University of powwow, and soon enough, I was just blown away how, you know, felt good and how amazing it felt. Powwow is there. It's our home. That's, no matter how people say it is, it's our home. That's our that's our teachings. You know, we carry on to that next gen.
And you just mentioned there that you went from, you know, the arbor dancing powwow to maybe the streets and the sidewalk dancing breakdancing. How did you break into breakdancing?
I started. What I did there. Yeah, you did. That's
just
awesome.
Kidding.
I started b-boying probably like when I was 12 years old. And I remember just being at a youth dance and seeing these couple of guys just, you know, going down the floor, and then hearing Run DMC, hearing, you know, Two Bass, like Grandmaster Flash, like old school hip hop, and just seeing them going down the floor. And I'm just like, damn, this is something I like doing. Wow. And I went home and tried. My mom thought I was like cleaning the floors. She's like, what are you doing, Josh? And I'm like, oh, I was trying to break dance. She's like, what kind of dance is that? I'm like, you know, hip hop. Oh, that kind of stuff. Okay. So I got into b-boying and learned about the four elements of hip hop, and, you know, I just learned the history of it. And then soon enough, I just really got good at it and just really had fun. And probably 6 months later, I started to get into talent shows, and then got into like going to Indian French Center at the time in Sault Ste. Marie. And it actually did help my balance and help my rhythm and help me, you know, groove as I go along, you know, just having fun. Wait, that's techno.
We're not there yet. Whoa,
not
whoa,
yet,
whoa.
Not yet. But yeah, I just learned about music. I learned how hip hop was and why b-boying came from like the streets of poverty in South Bronx, and, you know, just learning from the history and just learning about that and just looking back on it, and, you know, kind of made me went back into our history and learn about the fancy dance and learn about the powwow and learn about the history and why this drama was given to the men to, you know, settle down, don't act up no more. So like I started to see these things and started to see history and like, what? And that's when I, you know, burst out into different genres. And then I am proud that I still can break dance at 35.
Absolutely. You definitely have the rhythm in your body there. You went from powwow to breakdancing back to powwow. Would you say that was sort of your first mashup?
Yeah. And it was my very first mashup. And the cool thing about fancy dancing too is it is a contemporary style. So that's why I kind of add the you know, the top rock, the up rock, and, you know, going down and do like almost like a six step, like a halfway six step, but also just having fun in that regalia and having fun and just healing. And still, big reminder, stay grounded.
yeah, for sure. Literally, right? And for the audience members who don't know what the grass dance is, could you walk them through it a little bit or dance them through it a little bit?
Well, grass dancing was based on a society out west, and they flatten out the grass to heal the lands where they put their wigwams and but also protecting us around that big circle as we dance or as we do our harvest. I feel like that was a very important thing for grass dancers to be out there and, you know, heal us, but also heal themselves too. And in the modern day times, they have contemporary style of grass dancers. They do a lot of more footwork, but they still related to the flatting out the grass and respecting the history. And then same goes for fancy dancing. So fancy dancing came from the Oklahoma area, from the Poca and the Pawnee tribe, and was rediscovered in 1882 at the Buffalo Bill, the Wild West show. It was brought back in that time, and then it got popular after in the 40s. And then from there, it became like a sport, became a competitive style of dance. But also, you know, there are some amazing fancy dances out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you took the rhythm in your body that you expressed through hip hop, break dancing and hip hop powwow, and went into electronic music. How did that journey start for you?
I started to learn about techno, even house. I started to learn it from listening to disco music, like the Saturday Night Fever. You remember that album? Yeah.
Staying alive. Come on.
And then, so
I was born in the 70s.
Exactly. So I'm just saying, in that era, like, I've learned that disco was starting to die down because of protesting, et cetera, et cetera. But in the 80s and 90s, I noticed that it became recycled from Chicago. In the black community, there was like some originators like Frankie Knuckles that actually brought back that disco sound, but it became house music. Technically, in the modern days, it actually is disco music, but we call it house, but it's underground. So that was the coolest thing. I was just like, it almost relates to hip hop, where you can sample and chop it up and put it together and make it like a danceable, but also keep the rhythm going, keep it the dance flowing. And so I learned from disco, people sampling, and then soon enough I got learn about drum machines, and I started to learn about how to sample with drum machines and stuff like that, with drums and kits, and I got into producing. And then I learned about how Detroit became the capital of techno. And then overall, I just got drawn into it, and the dance music really was like, it was like the same as powwow. If the rhythm is 4-4 every time, that's what it was. And it just like, you can hear it. You can hear the Madewagen beating in your heart and just keep that rhythm going. And that's when I fell in love. And I said, Bumma P to hip hop. And I went straight to techno and house.
When did you make that connection? Like the 4-beat and the connection and the similar feelings?
I started to connect when I was in high school in grade 9, and I remember having a music software that my buddy gave me in a computer room, and he says, hey, try this out, man. I was like, oh, what is this? And then it was a CD of a music software called Reason. So I learned about the music software and then learned about how to make music on computer, and just from there, like I've self-taught myself how to make a 4-4 beat. The rhythm, the kick and the snare, the hi-hats, percussions, and just learning and then listening to other songs having those references really helped me to get all my music out. And overall, it made me stay out of trouble. I didn't go out or do anything bad or anything. It just straight up, I just stayed at home and learned about music and learned about music theory on my own. I didn't go to no classes whatsoever. I went straight to just, you know, making music from through a drum machine. And
Let's talk about your name a little bit. Where did the name Classic Roots come from?
Well, I'm a big fan of classical music, and you know, I consider anything classics, and then but also
like, you mean Beethoven classic, or do you mean like AC/DC Beethoven classic?
Oh, both. It could be old school and then modern. Yeah, I said Beethoven for sure. I always tell myself this. I was like, you know what? I'm going to be the next Beethoven and leave my songs here as I go in 100 years from now. So that's what I kind of make that good, strong connection with Beethoven. Yes. Yeah, I love classical music, even like scoring. I love John Williams. He's still kicking it. Hans Zimmer, classics like the Diphonics. Woo-wee. So yeah, I love my classic music. I love it. You know, like that's what keeps me driven. And then for roots, well, you know, I keep my native roots alive. Never back down, but always keep that momentum going, you know, keeping those roots alive.
Speaking of roots, your music takes you all over the country and, you know, music venues and whatnot, but you've also spent time traveling to different reserves to share your style of music. Why is it important for you to do that?
Growing up in the res, you know, I never saw DJing. The only time I saw DJing was my dad. And I just love to see people come out with good vibes. Like recently went to Fort Hope, Yabutat First Nation, and we danced till 2 a.m. I was playing techno, house, and of course play some hip hop once in a while. But I'm just saying, in the end of the day, I'm bringing that vibe, bringing that good vibe to them and showing them another way instead of having conflict, but also, you know, healing. And that's why I always tell everybody, have fun. I noticed that there's a lot of DJs don't dance to the music, but I do.
They just stand there stoically.
They stand stoically, you know? Yeah, just pushing buttons. No, you got to dance to your music. You got to feel it, you know? Like, that's how I see it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
everyone gets into it. Like, I remember in Fort Hope, like, no one was dancing. And I was like, you know what? Screw this. I'll play my one song. Boom. Jump on the dance floor and start dancing. And soon enough, everybody comes together. I was like, holy smokes. Oh, wow.
You just need somebody to start, right?
Yeah.
And is that generally the reaction when you go to communities? Because, you know, I'm thinking about when I was a kid in the school dance.
Yeah.
And all the boys would stand on one side, the girls would stand on the other and fidget fingers and be like, I don't want to go first.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that.
Is that sort of what you experienced?
Yep. I've experienced with people, you know, being shy. I remember this one person just being very, very shy for the whole hour. And then until I start going down, start breakdancing or start doing something, you know, fun, and the other DJ is playing, and then I'm just like grooving. And then soon enough, that person's slowly coming in, and starting doing some like crip walk or something. You know, like it was just like, it was like surprising, but I was just like, wow, he went out of his shell. It just takes time.
It's a beautiful thing to see, particularly music that you've created, reach, you know, people where they start out shy and then they start to move their shoulders. It's sort of like a butterfly being born, coming out of its shell, literally.
Yep.
How does it feel seeing that, like actually seeing that transformation?
I feel very proud of that. Like, I'm very happy to see, you know, a big change, even if it's not as big as you expect. You know, you see that one person out there who sees what you are doing. That's the beauty of dance, the beauty of music. You're bringing people together. It's coming back to like the full circle, powwowing.
Yeah. Absolutely. How important do you think music is when it comes to our celebrations and coming together?
Well, I believe that we bring that celebration all year round. More importantly, I think it's important to stay grounded, because at the end of the day, we're all healing through a lot of things in the past, but also healing through music. And I think it's important to see that music is there for you.
Well, Joshua, thank you so much for your gift of music and for your time today.
Miigwech, thank you.
Joshua DePerry is a member of Long Lake 58 and a powwow techno DJ and producer. He is a mashup master. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Casher, Danielle Piper, Rhiannon Johnson, Laura Bone Stubing, and Elena Hudgens-Lyle. You can always find more on our website, cbc.ca/unreserved. Download the podcast on the CBC Listen app or your favorite pod places. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Kanaskanamitnawa. I go say.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.